the way technology companies are different, it seems to me, and this was something I witnessed covering the Microsoft trial, in that my view was that the judge's decision, which was based on the recommendation of the Justice Department at the time, was that you had to break up Microsoft. And my view was that open source, et cetera, was going to break up Microsoft by itself. And that's proven to be true. And in that the world was moving so fast away from the command and control model of Microsoft, and that it would happen naturally, and you didn't have to engineer a bureaucratic solution for something that the marketplace was doing. And I mean, even today, if you switch forward today and you ask the question, which you are asking, of what about Google and its dominance in search, well, there's a story in today's New York Times that Google has, they have a little over 62% of the search business market share in the U.S. They have more overseas, by the way, but even overseas, they went from a two-thirds market share in China to roughly 15%. They are almost a zero factor in Korea, where I just recently was, and they're almost a zero factor in Russia, and they trail Yahoo in Japan. So. The world and the story today in the Times talked about how Bing was gaining market share. Now, still, Bing is roughly 15% market share. If you include them with Yahoo, they're at almost a third. But that world changes. And so you say, where is the monopoly question of restraint of trade in search that Google might exercise? And it seems to me, at least in my mind, there are two issues I would look at. One is, because of their two-thirds market share in the U.S., or slightly over that worldwide, is there a chance that Microsoft could lean on advertisers and basically restrain trade because of their market share? I mean, that evidence has not surfaced to date, that I'm aware of. Could it? Maybe. So it's something one should watch for, but it's not one that I'm aware there's any evidence of at this point. The second issue would be their algorithms. Can they game the system to favor some of their own sites, YouTube, for instance, in the search? And there you get into a more interesting area, it seems to me, for antitrust law, which is that most companies in the internet world are transparent. Google is not. At least they're not transparent when it comes to their algorithms. Now, there's a good reason not to be transparent, in that you don't want people to game the system. And if you go to these search engine marketing meetings, which unfortunately I've been to two in my life, and hopefully I won't have to go to another one, you have all of these people, I mean, thousands of people, and they're basically preaching that if you hire us as a marketing consultant, we will figure out a way to game the system, because we will know how to play the Google search results so that we could tweak your company so it will rank higher on the search results. And if you look at one of the reasons, say, for instance, the Huffington Post's great success is that it's search engine optimization. They literally figure out how to write headlines that will grab the Google search and basically game the system. And every company in the world tries to do that today, and if they're sophisticated. Now, the problem is we can't tell the success because Google won't tell us what the algorithm is. And as I said a moment ago, they have good reasons not to, because they want to avoid that. On the other hand, they have sites that benefit from being ranked higher, like YouTube, and there are sites that complain that they've been punished by Google when the algorithms were changed. So that's an area that is worth people exploring, it seems to me.
It's interesting that you mention Yahoo in Japan, I don't know if you've seen the news that Yahoo Japan has just decided that they're going to be powered by Google as opposed to Microsoft Bing, which is what they announced last year.
I did see that, and it was quite interesting. And one of the reasons for that is that Yahoo in the United States only owns 25% of Yahoo Japan. SoftBank is a Japanese company that owns 75%. So they basically are making a decision that could not have pleased Yahoo in the United States.
Yeah.
They made the decision, by the way, to SoftBank in Japan is also going to, they are the company that will be, that is bringing out the iPhone in Japan and the iPad.
Speaking of the iPad, I read your article from a few months ago on Amazon and Amazon with the Kindle versus Apple and the iPad vis-a-vis the book industry. And I was wondering if you had a comment on either one of those companies sort of coming out with a monopoly on the e-book business and being able
well,
to dictate
you look,
what
yeah,
model
I mean,
we
if,
go
if,
with.
If you look at the part of the a theme that emerged from that piece you described is that the publishers in the United States were terrified that Amazon was creating a monopoly, and that an e-book monopoly. And what they were doing, the publishers feared, is because almost all e-books were being sold through Amazon at the time. And because Amazon was even though they were paying, say, $14.95 for a book, they were for an e-book, they were charging $9.99, and therefore they were subsidizing the e-book price. You know, they were losing money on the book in order to make money on the sale of Kindles, the device. And what publishers were terrified of was that Amazon, once it had more than 80%, it already had 80% at the time of e-book sales, what they would wind up doing is squeezing the publishers to force them to sell them e-books at a lower price than $14.95 or $12.95, whatever the price was that they were paying, and would continue to lower the price and ultimately would put the publishers out of business. Secondly, they were worried that Amazon was going to do something else, which they in fact were doing, as I reported, that Amazon would try and become a publisher themselves and cut out publishers as a kind of a middleman. And Amazon would do it themselves and tell authors, hey, publish your book with us and we'll give you, instead of a royalty of 15%, we'll give you 50% or more. And so publishers were terrified and terribly pleased when Apple got in the business, because it gave them leverage over Amazon, and equally pleased that Google is getting in the business and that Barnes & Noble has the Nook in the business. So this gave, and part of what that piece was about was that publishers were gaining leverage, back leverage that they had lost, and lessened their fear of Amazon's monopoly power.
As a writer, you have a sort of unique perspective in that you're both writing about the issue, and you have a very real stake in the issue. So, coming from the perspective of being a writer,
as an author, right?
As an author, is there? Mm-hmm. Do you have sort of your loyalties with one camp or the other?
Well, I like the idea as a citizen. I like the idea of competition. So, you know, I have a stake in wanting to have, competition against anyone who might become monopoly, be it Microsoft 10 years ago or Amazon today. But do I feel a stake in who wins that outcome? No, I hope no one wins. I hope Google is powerful and Amazon's powerful and Apple is powerful and Barnes & Noble is powerful and or at least do well enough to assure that there's competition. And if that's true, it seems to me that authors have a benefit as well as do citizens. But I actually, when you asked the question, I mean, I've never thought about whether I as an author, sitting here, do I have a rooting interest in Amazon or Apple? Or No, I have a rooting interest in as a citizen, and I guess therefore as an author, and as well in competition. But and I do. There is an issue which I do think about, and this creates a potential conflict of interest, and that is that one of the things that's unclear for authors, and I didn't get into this in my piece because it would have taken another 7,000 words to do, is it's not at all clear who owns ebook rights. And I mean, I touched on this a little bit in the piece, saying that, you know, there was a trial and a court case, and Random House lost in 2000, in which they claimed that ebook rights were implied in their contracts with people like Kurt Vonnegut and William Styron. And the court ruled that that's not true, that an implied right is not a right, and it has to be spelled out in the contract the way paperback rights were spelled out or movie rights were spelled out. But now as you move forward, those contracts, there are a number of contracts that are still unclear, and this battle that's brewing and has not yet quite surfaced but will, between publishers who claim an implied right to books, ebook rights, that were negotiated, contracts that were negotiated 10 or more years ago. In other words, for the Hemingways, et cetera, et cetera. And then, so that's one issue, and agents and authors are claiming, no, you can't have an implied right, and we already thought that was adjudicated in the court in 2000. And so that's one issue that is bubbling up below the surface. But a second one that's even more invisible is the issue of when you sell an ebook to Amazon or to Apple, and if you sell it to, under the new agency agreement that I wrote about, you sell that book for, let's say, $14.95, right? It could be $13.95, but whatever the price of the book. If it's a $30 book, it's basically $14.99, and if it's a $28 book, it's a dollar. You know, it's a dollar. But so if you sell them that book, and yet under the agency agreement, you're giving Amazon or Apple or Google or Barnes and Noble 30% commission, right? Does the author's share come out of the gross or the net number? And by that, what I mean is the authors would claim, and agents may claim for them, that they should be paid their commission based on the $14.99 sale price to Amazon or Apple, not on the net price of what the book is sold for. And that's an issue that is sold to the customer for, which is $9.99. So that's an issue that will surface and has not yet gotten the visibility I think it will get at some point. And obviously, as an author, you have a stake in that. You'd rather have the gross commission rather than the net commission.
Mm-hmm. And this sort of leads naturally into the issue of the Google book settlement, creating sort of a monopoly for Google in terms of selling of orphan works. So do you have an opinion on that? Do you think that was a good idea? Do you think it was a bad idea? I understand that it was very, very controversial among the authorship community.
I think Google's agreeing to pay on a larger point. I'm going to get to the orphan book issue next, but on the larger point, I think the fact that Google agreed to pay authors and publishers $125 million for the rights, their copyrights to their books, is a very significant move forward in terms of those who believe that copyrights should, you know, that you need to protect copyright, reasonable copyright. I'm not talking about Disney and Mickey Mouse, as Mr. Lessig would call it, but that you should pay for it, and that information should not be free. So in a way, it was a very early acknowledgement by Google, which had never before acknowledged it, that all information was not free, and fair use did not allow them to just take whatever they wanted to. And so I think that's significant. Now, the question you raised, I think, is a very important one about orphan books. And what gives Google the right to suddenly claim that these books that we can't find who the copyright holder is, we automatically could do with what we want with them. And that's an issue that I'm happy the judge is looking at, and how it's resolved, I have no idea. But I think it's an important issue. And I know what some of you folks have set up, at Harvard about that, and your friend of the court briefs and elsewhere, and I think that you raise some, valuable and important issues.
So thank you very much for talking to us.
Great. Bye.